Hello, this is Janet Gowan welcoming you to Love Letters Live. Today's guest is Kevin Smokler, who is the author of Brat Pack America, a love letter to the teen movies of the 80s. Is that the full title?
That's correct. Okay. Thanks, Janet, for having me.
I'm so glad you're here. When I read about you, I could not help but get on the phone quick because that love letter to the teen movies was a real come to mama. So I'm so glad you did. So that's going to be...
Me too.
Tell me about you first. You were raised, you said, in Michigan.
Yeah, I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. My parents met at the university there. I was a total college town university kid. I came from a very cerebral academic family. Except my parents were culture addicts and brought that on and passed that on to me. I grew up in a house with tons of records and books and subscriptions to five or six different concert series and either the television or the stereo or the
So you were always open to whatever was visible or audible.
Very much so.
And culture that was,
And I've kind of carried that on into my adult
life. Your own
generation. I'm 43 and I'm very much like that now.
Okay. Yeah. Now, what did you always write? I mean, how did you get, just in a word or two?
Yeah.
How did you go for this? Because this is quite a work.
Yeah, I've always written since I was a kid. This is my third book, and with each one, I set a personal challenge for myself. And the challenge for this one was, can I tell a long story, a story that extends over 10 years, over 55 films, over an entire decade of American history, and have it all kind of hang together.
Well, story. I was overwhelmed, as I told you when you first walked in, totally overwhelmed, because the book, I don't approach anything really with a pre-vision of what it is. I must say, I walk into things pretty much a blank slate, which I like. But this was quite a work of history, which I didn't expect. This was a really kind of a serious historical work on the movies. There was no gossip quality to it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a couple reasons. One, I mean, I don't consider myself a historian. I don't have the kind of academic
rigor. Nor are you a gossip columnist.
No, I don't have the academic rigor that comes with being a historian, nor do I have the interest in being a gossip columnist.
So what was your goal in this besides telling? What drew you to this? Just because it was your era?
Yeah, but I was... These are the movies of my childhood, but there's been a lot of great books written about these movies, and so I was sort of casting about for something interesting to say about them. And what I ultimately realized was that growing up in the middle of the country, I felt like pop culture, which was the thing I loved the most in the world, was all made and about somewhere else.
Okay.
That it was all about New York or the Northeast or California.
Now, so pop culture is something that we did not have when I was a girl. That is a fairly...
Interesting meaning?
No, you never heard the phrase.
That's...
I mean, I started hearing it when my kids were young, and I think it kind of happened. I was first aware of it as a question or an issue with Gwyneth Paltrow naming her first child Apple. It was on a... I think that's right. Is that correct?
I know her first child was named Apple, but what was the first record you ever bought?
Oh, the first... Well, the records that we had in our home were all classical.
Mm-hmm. But with your own money, what was the first record you...
With my own money. You know, with my own money, it was actually a Doily Cart, Gilbert and Sullivan. But I did get, for my 16th birthday, the Johnny Mathis album with Wonderful, Wonderful.
Yeah, and wasn't that referred to as popular music? I mean...
Oh, popular music, yes, but not pop culture.
There wouldn't have been a
category in which you would have been asked your knowledge on pop culture that would have included anything about Molly Ringwald.
I wonder if...
I may have just been out of it.
No, I don't think you were. I think there's a more present day phenomenon, which is that the different areas of culture used to be, at least from a consumer point of view, I believe used to be far more siloed than they are now. It was far less common. It was much more common when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s to meet someone who was either a books person or a music person or a movie person. Now, particularly for people that are younger than us, everybody's an everything person.
Oh, that's another interesting thing. A movies person. Now there are people who, yes, they analyze movies. I mean, it's a serious subject like literature used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember kind of, I'm still not used to that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm, you know, video games are a serious subject now.
Yes.
And I still remember when video games was controlling two dots chasing each other.
Oh, like
that, yeah, that was that, exactly. that was the video games that,
yeah,
I grew up with.
Yes.
But if you look at the skill and the artistry and the narrative that goes in video games are the storytelling medium of our time.
That's
so
right. And Molly Ringwald was speaking to people as surely as as the Bronte sisters were.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. And in a very interesting way, if you're talking about cinema, mm-hmm. Because the idea that young people can tell their own stories had arrived in American popular music sort of the generation before.
I would say
with the birth of rock and roll.
Isn't that a wonderful thing?
I think it's fair to say that songs like Leader of the Pack are all about young people telling their own stories.
When you say the birth of rock and roll, how far back do you go? Because I remember the transition from the 40s to Shaboom.
I chart that about with Elvis and Sun Records Chuck Berry and Little Richard about 1957.
Oh, so still 50s.
Okay, yeah. So I think the birth of rock and roll is premised on the idea of young people telling their own stories. That doesn't come to American cinema until the late 1970s.
I see. What was the first one that you would credit with that?
In this book, in Brat Pack America, I give credit to that. I give credit to that to a little movie called Breaking Away,
mm-hmm.
Which was about four friends in Bloomington, Indiana, who had just graduated from high school.
Bicycling. Yes, I remember.
The screenplay won an Oscar.
Mm-hmm.
Who are kind of wondering what to do next with their lives. And unlike American Graffiti, which had come out 8 years before, the kids in that movie didn't represent anything. American Graffiti came out in 1973, so it was 6 years before Breaking Away, but it was about 1961.
Mm-hmm.
And so the characters in American Graffiti are vehicles of nostalgia for adults watching American Graffiti. American Graffiti was not for teenagers. It was for grown-ups. The kids in Breaking Away don't represent anything. They don't represent a political or a social problem the way the kids in Rebel Without a Cause did.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. Okay,
yeah.
So how do you classify that?
Yeah, they don't represent a contemporary political moment the way Riot on the Sunset Strip or Medium Cool represented.
Mm-hmm.
They don't represent a look back at something else the way Bonnie and Clyde or American Graffiti did. They simply were the center of their own story.
Okay, so could you give us a couple of titles that are the center of their own story? Would you consider Pretty in Pink?
Yeah, the 80s teen movie is mm-hmm. where that begins. And to my mind, the 80s teen movie begins with Breaking Away in 1979. Its older brothers and sisters are movies like Animal House and Fame and The Warriors. And really, its first descendants are Star Wars and Jaws, which single-handedly drag the American movie audience downward into youth. The American movie audience becomes 10 years younger thanks... The American movie buying public becomes 10 years younger thanks
you mean
to
that,
Star Wars
You mean
and
that
Jaws.
Literally?
Yeah.
Those who are going to the movies
yeah.
and... Uh-huh.
Yeah. Over the course of a decade, beginning in about 1975. So begins with Breaking Away, peaks probably in 85 and 86 with The Breakfast Club and Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and then ends in 1989 with Heathers.
Now, when you were growing up and watching these movies... Well, this is kind of a different question. To write a book like this, this is kind of a silly question, I guess. You must have had to really watch each of these movies many times.
I had to watch all of them again at least once. There are 55. There are 55 movies in this book. I had to watch all of them again at least once. Some of them I've seen so many times that it's like watching them is
Part
like reciting
you.
A nursery rhyme. Like you don't like I don't really I didn't really need to see them more than that.
But you're watching them slightly differently than most people.
Yeah, yeah. And some of them I had dim memories of because I hadn't seen them a long time. And those I had to see several times again.
And your parents are. What's their reaction to this?
It's funny. My parents had three kids
mm-hmm.
and professional jobs.
What do they do?
My parents were psychologists,
mm-hmm.
And And in the 80s, they had three kids and psychology practices, and they were younger than I am now.
Yeah.
So they, when I tell them about what was going on for me at that time in both pop culture and in the world at large, they mostly shake their head and say, "We just don't remember much of it. We were overwhelmed with our own lives," and I totally understand that. And my parents in semi-retirement now remember every book they read, every theatrical presentation they go to, every concert they hear. I mean, I totally get that. So it is a bit. The time was a bit of a blur for them, and the association I try and make.
I think sometimes when you have young children, you can be so busy protecting them that you don't notice them.
Absolutely, yes. And I think I remember when John Hughes died in 2009, and I was broken up. I was devastated, and I remembered calling my parents and trying to explain it to them, and I wrongly assumed they wouldn't get it. I was completely wrong, actually. And they said, and I said sort of self-righteously, "This is exactly like when John Lennon was killed."
Uh-huh.
And that's the only way I'll make you understand it. And they just said, "Kevin, we liked his movies too."
Oh, so they didn't need
the help. They totally got it. Yeah.
Now, I was going to ask you about, you were going to talk about some of the people who made these movies. I'd like to know about that.
Yeah, I mean, there were a number of great filmmakers who kind of got their start on these films. Obviously, John Hughes is no longer with us. He's kind of the one we most associate with these movies. But thankfully, Amy Heckerling and Martha Coolidge are still with us.
Yes.
Amy Heckerling, in fact, made what could arguably be the defining teen movie of two different decades, which is an accomplishment nobody has achieved. Martha Coolidge, of course, made Valley... Made Valley Girl and Real Genius within 2 years of each other. Somehow Martha Coolidge managed to make Valley Girls and engineering students cool within 2 years of each other. That I don't think anybody's accomplished that since. Savage Steve Holland made three great movies at that time and has mostly been focused on TV since. But those movies are now considered pioneering by an entire generation of comedy writers. And so everybody's eager for Savage Steve Holland to get back behind the director's camera. And it looks like hopefully that might be happening sometime soon. Cameron Crowe, of course, began as a screenwriter during this time and would become a director of considerable renown the decade afterwards in the 1990s.
Now, talk about, you start off by saying, raised in the Midwest, movies were always about someplace else. Talk about the someplace else, because I grew up in that someplace else, I think.
Yeah, I mean, growing up in Ann Arbor, Michigan, the most obvious example is my beloved University of Michigan football team. If they had a championship season, they played the Rose Bowl not in snowy, cloudy Michigan, but in sun-kissed, in January, Pasadena. And so my feeling was always great things, and to me, popular culture was the greatest of all happened elsewhere. It was made in New York and California. It was frequently about New York and California.
Why is that?
Most of that is financial. Some of it is because in the 1980s, the period I was talking about, local film commissions hadn't begun as a civic phenomenon. Now every city in the country has a film commission designed
to... Yes, and festivals.
Exactly. The film festival ecosystem wasn't as big as it is now. Now it's very common for a city's film commission to get some heat and for 12 films in a year to be made in Pittsburgh or Wilmington, North Carolina or something like that. In a couple of years, I should say. But it's very common for certain markets to show up disproportionately on screen than used to be the case in the period of time that I write about in this book.
Did you leave Michigan in search of these places?
You mean in writing the book?
Yes. Or no, at any point in your life. Is that how... What was your exit from Michigan?
I didn't have a real sense that you could go somewhere to where a movie had been filmed until I was about 18 years old. And I made friends with someone who had grown up in South Pasadena at summer camp. And I came out to visit him one year, and he asked me if I wanted to see Doc Brown's house from Back to the Future. And I said, "What are you talking about? Like, Doc Brown's house is a pile of wood on some studio lot somewhere where, with tour buses driving by.
Right.
And he goes, no, it's a real place. And, of course, we went to the historic Gamble House in South Pasadena, and he said, this is it. This is the hill where Doc Brown comes storming down, holding the blueprints in his hands, and says, so tell me, future boy, who's president in 1985? And we acted out the whole scene right there on the lawn, and it was the first time that I had ever understood that you could actually stand somewhere where a movie was being filmed. In the 1980s, movies simply weren't filmed in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, flash forward 20 years, and you've got The Ides of March and The Five-Year Engagement and Whip It and all of those movies that were filmed in Ann Arbor, Michigan. But back then, that was not the case. So that was all those years ago, when I was 18 years old, that was kind of the genesis of the idea for this book, that that there was something magical about standing in the place where a movie was made. And somehow that was testimony to its permanence. And to me, that was an interesting way to look at what was great about the 80s teen movie. I think the things we know already, like the dialogue and the memorable lines and performances and plots and direction, we kind of know, and music, of course, we know all that already. The idea that there was something etched into the American landscape about the 80s teen movie was really interesting to me.
Was there something overriding in these movies that was victorious? It seems to me the movies that I can recall, which is a lot of them, of this era and teen movies, is victory over difficulty.
There was a fair amount of that. I would say that idea was largely in sort of, this is a sloppy term, but it was largely in the sort of more mainstream of those movies.
Uh-huh.
The movies that John Hughes kind of represented were the equivalent of the pop music of the 80s teen film, which were basically about good kids from good homes struggling over a certain kind of adversity and ultimately triumphing, mostly by being good kids. The sort of college radio version of the 80s teen film, which was darker and less seen, were movies like Over the Edge and The Legend of Billie Jean, which were almost apocalyptic visions of what it, and Repo Man is an example of that, almost apocalyptic visions of what it meant to be young in America. And they all had this vaguely nihilistic sense that to be young in America is to be growing up in a country that doesn't like you, doesn't want you, and largely views you as kind of a fugitive from justice.
Well, and at least the enemy. I mean, that has been true forever, that one generation regards the next as kind of an enemy for wanting to be different.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, no, that's
understandable.
It is an idea that has carried forth as long as there has been young people, as long as there has been teen movies. And the teen movie goes back minimum at least as far as about the early 1950s.
Okay.
We can say the genre was not invented in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Far from it.
What's the first movie you ever saw?
The first movie I ever saw, The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, well, probably a lot of people saying
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I was seven.
Of course, yes.
But the idea that, the idea of that, the misunderstanding between generations that happens at this time is a direct descendant of the horror movies from the 1970s. If you notice, the horror movies from the 1970s had a whole lot of movies about kids, children possessed by the devil,
sure,
or possessed by evil.
As they are,
yes, of course. You're talking about The Omen and The Shining,
yes,
and The Exorcist.
Wow. I love those.
I did not come up with this theory, but people who study horror movies have said horror movies are always about addressing our fears.
Yeah.
And the fear that was is people coming out of the 1960s, settling down and having families, and being terrified of what it meant to become their parents, to become parents themselves. And so the manifestation was the little creature that you brought into your lives suddenly becoming monstrous.
Mm-hmm.
Now, flash forward 10 years to the
19... Or giving you some horrible message of rejection by saying, I don't want to be like you.
Exactly.
Like, grow my hair down. Mm-hmm.
So flash forward 10 years, and Linda Blair in The Exorcist is now a teenager. And so what you get is movies like Over the Edge, like The Legend of Billie Jean, like Taps, and like Heathers, which all are reflective of this 60s parents' fear of a world run by teenagers run wild. basically who they were
yes,
in the 1960s.
Exactly.
So there is a lot of there's a lot of inveighing in those movies about how irresponsible and reckless and destructive this generation is. And I guess it depends on
who. And I think the phrase "kids today" has been around forever.
There is a one of the things I dug up in the research of for Brat Pack America was a quote that basically said, "I do not know what the matter is with the youth of today. They are irresponsible. They are selfish. They care only about themselves. And society is going to be in ruins once they take over." Do you know who said that? I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but do you know who said that?
Oh, I'm going to try to guess who said that. Richard Nixon? I have no idea. What? Who?
Socrates.
Okay. Didn't expect that.
So,
okay,
so we have been saying a version of
that. I was going to say Eisenhower, but I thought that was too long ago. Oh, my goodness.
So we have been saying a version of that since there have been teenagers.
Sure.
And the movies I just named were simply how that played out at that particular moment in American history and in cinematic history.
Now, you were talking about fears and changing fears. And
yeah.
I read something, because fears apparently have changed, and I read something maybe about a year ago that really stunned me and has nothing to do really with, well, it does have to do with movies, actually, that when I was a girl, the fear, the main fear, the most horrible thing that could happen. What do you think kids were the most afraid of in the late 40s, early 50s? Take a guess.
Nuclear war.
No, that came a little later.
Nazis.
Quicksand.
Oh, yes, I've heard this story. I've heard this story.
And I can understand. You saw it in the Westerns. You saw some guy just being sucked down. And, oh, it was horrible.
Yeah.
It was horrible.
And
quicksand.
And there's some point in history where quicksand stops being...
That's right. You ask young kids today, they have no fear of quicksand.
No.
And by the way, apparently it's not what it was portrayed as.
Right.
It's not a great thing to get caught in, but you won't get schlooped up like down a toilet either.
Yeah.
But today, apparently, they are afraid of those kind of robot monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you? Yes.
Yeah. I don't watch horror movies, for example, that often, but there was a whole beginning about 10 years ago. There was a whole slew of horror movies that were all based on the premise of being unreachable.
Oh yes, like that little kid who was sucked into the television.
Yeah, they were all based on the premise of being being not able to communicate with the outside world.
Yes.
So it was a lot of horror movies about people being kidnapped in foreign countries and stuff
that.
So it is a very 21st century fear when everybody's walking around with a communication device in their pocket.
And yes, that's right, and not communicating so well.
Yeah.
Very often.
So right. So the I had a whole chapter on horror movies in this book that ultimately didn't end up making the final edit, but the horror movies of the 1980s were very explicitly tied to the missing children phenomenon of the 1980s.
Well,
was that the sort of Chrysler GM,
yes, yes.
The Chrysler GM and Ford of the horror movies of the 1980s were Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all movies not about vampires and witches. Those are all movies about the killer next door.
Yes. Rosemary's Baby, by the way.
Right. Someone who is enacting judgment and revenge upon you because of behavior that you have partaken in. Someone who is, in fact, whose murders are, in fact, a kind of moral judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something very sort of Reagan-era and conservative about that idea.
Well, you know, a lot of movies, by the way, have that political undertone. Do you remember the movie The Body Snatchers, the original one?
Certainly, yeah.
I mean, that was such an anti-communist propaganda thing. The Body Snatchers and the pods and the, goodness.
Yeah, the...
It's still scary, but it's a little laughable.
Yes.
But it is frightening.
It is. It was. I appreciated the compliment, but when you said this book was a serious history, I think what was
it felt like it.
Thank you. I think what was important to me is that I not be ignorant of the time that these movies were being watched when people were buying tickets and going to see
them. But you are also taking a serious look at the times in the movies rather than focusing on the, you know, gossipy factors of any of the people. That was lovely.
Thank you. It just doesn't interest me very much, I'm not trained as an entertainment journalist, so it's not my natural inclination to find a scoop scoops, in fact, don't interest me very much.
Okay, so that's a difference. I didn't realize there was such a yes.
Yeah, and so to me, the interesting thing is always the interesting thing about writing about something that a lot of people have an experience and a story attached to is what I sort of informally call Abraham Lincoln's hand, which is if you look at the Lincoln Memorial, Abraham Lincoln's right hand is clutching the end of the chair. And we tend to think of Abraham Lincoln as sitting sort of in repose like a pharaoh in a tomb. And in fact, if you look at the Lincoln Memorial, you'll never be able to see it the same way again. He's in the middle of standing up.
Oh, my goodness.
So I am interested in the stuff we think we know that is hiding in plain sight.
Oh, good for you.
So that's why scoops don't interest me.
Okay,
I'm
really
interested
nice
in taking a long, hard look at something and seeing what reveals itself.
Well, it was
like
so
Abraham
satisfying,
Lincoln's
this book. It was so satisfying. And I have one other thing I did want to ask you about. I have a friend who, excuse me, Dana Fredstein. I don't know if you know of her.
I don't think so.
She's a horror story writer. Mm-hmm. And she was a stunt woman, actually, for you. Okay. Mm-hmm. But she was talking about the vampires and zombies, both of real interest. And at one point she said, vampires can be really sexy. Zombies are just vile. Is that you're smiling? Is that your...
No, it's a common... I've heard
things... I never
things.
Would have thought of those fine differences.
So vampires are...
When you were talking about horror movies.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, what I've heard is vampires are cyclical and zombies are representative. Every generation has their vampire story. In the 1980s, the great vampire movie was The Lost Boys.
Yes.
And, and in that movie, the vampires are representative of the counterculture. That movie is in fact, and this is part of the reason it was filmed in Santa Cruz. It is a conservative rebuke of people who dress weird and look weird, it equates them with vampires.
I see.
And a town like Santa Cruz, which is so far gone from what it used to be that a nest of vampires can hide in plain sight. Nobody cares enough about them too. So that's the message put forth. And but you know, soon after, in the 90s, we get the Anne Rice novels.
I was just going to mention that because the Anne Rice novels. You had to feel such sympathy for those people. They didn't ask for it.
No.
I mean, yes, that little girl.
Right.
Who was gotten at three.
Yeah.
What was her name? Charlotte?
Yeah.
Yes. And the poor thing, she knew how unfair it was.
Right. Okay. The Anne Rice novels take us directly to Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And the idea of vampire-ness being a job, a role that someone is stuck with as a kind of destiny.
Yes.
And then, of course, you know...
But zombies don't ask for it either.
No. No, but zombies are usually more transparent. Zombies are usually more representative of something. Zombies are representative of where we are and what we're afraid of, like in a way that vampires typically are not.
Oh, this is so much fun. Yeah. Will you come back another time?
Anytime.
And talk about
something else?
Yeah,
of course, yeah.
I could go on for hours, but I'm geared to 30 minutes. So I want to thank you for doing this with me. And just because I am Love Letters, will you please tell me what made you choose that for a title? You must have felt.
Yeah, it was really important to me that this book be a certain kind of love. I think it is very evident just from reading a few pages that I feel like these movies are amazing, and that these movies hold up remarkably well, and these movies deserve every ounce of praise and adoration they have. Like there is a reason that Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Back to the Future and The Goonies and Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink have been popular since the day they were born.
So they must all be speaking somehow for you that you feel this.
I think it helped that I was young at that time, but mm-hmm. all in all, I just think they're great movies. Okay. And they're great movies for reasons that I'd go on for an hour naming
okay, well,
how they're great.
Okay, well, let's come back, and yeah. Oh, let's do that next time.
Sure. But I think I think the love letter part of this is, it was very clear to me that I was crazy about these movies, and I conveyed that in this book. But I wanted it to be a grown-up love
yes.
where I spent thoughtful, considered time with them.
I have a question to ask you. Do you ever write letters?
Frequently, yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
May I ask to whom? What kind?
I write a lot of thank you notes. I write a lot of – I sometimes write how are you doing notes.
On stationery with kids
yeah.
so people
yeah.
can keep them.
I feel like my profession gets very few toys. So I have a thing for quality stationery and pens.
Oh, good for you. Mm-hmm. Okay, me too.
Yeah.
Have you ever written fan letters?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Because I am big on encouraging people to write fan letters as love letters, which they are.
I think it's very important that we express outward admiration for the people who make things that,
yes.
that we like. And that we not just keep our enthusiasm to ourselves.
Thank you. That's exactly what I say. Because gratitude or appreciation taken to the grave serves no one.
I couldn't have said it better myself.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, I'm so glad we met. And until next time, this is Janet Gallen saying goodbye, and I hope that Kevin will come back soon and we'll do another one.
Oh, I really appreciate you
Thank
having
you,
me, Janet.
Dear.
Thank you.
Bye.